I'm William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com with another All About Jack, a C.S. Lewis podcast. In the show today, I'm sharing a 20-minute academic paper Dr. Don Williams presented at Taylor University that was a part of the 9th Francis White Eubank Colloquium on C.S. Lewis and Friends. Dr. Williams' official title was Cartographer of the Divine, and it explored the challenges in considering C.S. Lewis as a theologian. The material he presented is the groundwork for a book that he is in the middle of writing. I found the talk very interesting and obtained his permission to not only share it, but also a copy of the Word document that he had as a handout. It contained some additional information he could not share due to the limitations of time he was allowed to speak. So be sure to check the show notes at EssentialCSLewis.com for a link to that, as well as to Don's website and other related content.
We're talking about C.S. Lewis as a theologian. There hasn't been that much work done on Lewis as a theologian, even though he's the most influential Christian thinker of the 20th century. And so I'm going to ask, why not, and what are the challenges, and what needs to be done in order to get a handle on Lewis's theology? We've had a number of books looking at individual doctrines, but Will Vaus has written a book that tries to cover the whole thing. And that book, Mere Theology, is a good book, but it's almost all summary. Not that much analysis or critique. So my big project right now is trying to write a book on Lewis's theology that would cover the whole thing systematically and ask the question, how biblical is this? Where is Lewis a good guide to understanding Christian doctrine? Where is it more questionable? Where should we maybe slow down a little bit? So, use your specimens while you can. There aren't going to be many more dinosaurs. And I don't know if there are going to be many more theologians who actually know how to write, Lewis being the last one. When George Sayer's first meeting with his New Oxford tutor, C.S. Lewis, ended, another Oxford faculty member named J.R.R. Tolkien was waiting to see Lewis next. How did the young fresher get on with Lewis, Tolkien wanted to know. Rather well, Sayer figured, adding that he thought Lewis was going to make quite an interesting mentor. Interesting, Tolkien replied. Yes, he's certainly that. You'll never get to the bottom of him. Well, this essay isn't going to get to the bottom of Lewis either. It will, though, try to indicate why Lewis matters, not just as a Christian fantasy writer and apologist, but as a theologian, a teacher of the church. Lewis's theology is, somewhat surprisingly, a relatively neglected aspect of his influence. Other book-length studies focus on Lewis's approach to just one doctrine. We don't yet have a book that takes a look at Lewis's presentation of Christian doctrine as a unified whole and asks what are its strengths and weaknesses as a guide to biblical faith. That's a hole that I eventually hope to try to fill. It's a strange hole to find in Lewis' studies. For while he was not a professional theologian, Lewis might well have gotten more Christian doctrinal content into more heads than anyone else who was a professional theologian in his day or since. He saw himself as a translator, putting abstruse theological truths back into the language of the people, because the professional theologians had forgotten that these truths were for the people of God. They tend to write as if the truths of theology are for other theologians. Lewis said, with excessive self-deprecation, if the real theologians had tackled this laborious work of translation about 100 years ago, when they began to lose touch with the people for whom Christ died, there would have been no place for me. The place was there, and we may be glad for the way Lewis filled it. Lewis, then, may be the most important amateur theologian ever. Many people testify to having been brought to Christ by Lewis's writings, many more to having been preserved in the faith by discovering him in a period of doubt and questioning. Half a century after his death, almost all his books are still in print, and his popularity shows no signs of fading. As an evangelist, an apologist, an expounder, and an incarnator in fiction of the faith. Lewis was one of the most imaginatively winsome and logically forceful ambassadors for Christianity we have seen. For that very reason, it behooves us to cultivate a critically sound judgment about his influence. What is the theology that lies behind the popular apologetics, the Narnia books, and the Space Trilogy? How biblical is it? What are its strengths and its weaknesses? Where does Lewis succeed in explaining and portraying the truth about Christ? And where in those presentations should we be wary or withhold our judgment? These are all questions that need to be answered, and I'm going to try to explain why in the following pages. Now, I'm not going to say much about Lewis's life, but what interests me in Lewis's life is the consistent manifestation in it of two traits which rarely appear in such strength in the same person, and which in combination are what make Lewis a theologian still worthy of our attention half a century after his death. They were, first, a fertile imagination, alive to the beauty and mystery of life, along with a sharp logical mind, capable of deep critical analysis. It was precisely this combination that, in his atheist phase, wouldn't let him rest content in his unbelief. He writes in his autobiography of the frustration of believing only in atoms in motion, while caring only about gods and heroes and the great myths. A lesser man might have just given up on the gods and myths and become cynical. Lewis could not. He wrote to his friend Arthur Greaves on the 23rd of May, 1918, "Fairies must be in the woods, or the satyr's merry broods, Triton in the summer sea. Else how could the dead things be half so lovely as they are? Atoms dead could never thus move the human heart of us, unless the beauty that we see part of endless beauty be." Atoms dead could never thus move the human heart of us. Lewis saw a contradiction in the philosophy he had accepted. Not yet a contradiction in its logic, that would come later, but a contradiction between his reductionistic materialist philosophy and life itself. It would take him some time to resolve that impasse with many false starts. The Christian resolution would be some time in coming, but when it came, it would come in the form precisely of a healing of the troubling dichotomy. He would write his brother warning in October of 1931, that William Law's appeal to all that doubt or disbelieve is one of those rare works which makes you think of Christianity. Here is the very thing you like in poetry and romances, only this time it's true. Poetry? True. Yes. It was the dual impulse to both imagination and reason, plus the compulsion to find some kind of unity between them that would not be in conflict with life as we actually experience it, that drove Lewis long before he concluded that the answer to this problem is found in Christ. We can see it coming already. Rational apologetics that is full of apt analogy and that could only come from the imagination, and imaginary worlds of haunting beauty that contain as integral components pieces of logical reasoning like Puddleglum's refutation of the Green Witch. We step from one to the other seamlessly, and that is why Lewis's theology matters. It is the theology for a Christian life that refuses to be reduced either to cold reason or to passionate emotion. It also refuses to compromise either to get the other. With whatever flaws we may discover it to have, it is a theology that flows from the drive to wholeness. Its ability to lead us in the direction of wholeness is a significant reason why we are still reading it, and it is the reason why we should also want to study it. Well, there are some difficulties with the project of trying to study Lewis as a theologian. These may be some of the reasons why there's not been nearly enough work done in this field. They are the polarization that Lewis unintentionally causes, the fact that many of his theological statements occur in fiction. Theologians aren't used to expounding fiction. The fact that publicly he only gave us mere Christianity, did not deal with conflicts between different Christian traditions, which meant that a lot of the content of theology was actually out of bounds. The sheer volume of his work, all of these things present difficulties. So, let me say just a little bit about each one. The first problem is polarization. Ironically, given his commitment to mere Christianity, Lewis is a surprisingly polarizing force. He has attracted, on the one hand, an almost idolatrous kind of admiration from a certain kind of evangelical, and been the subject of writings from that group that can only be called hagiography. In reaction to this, on the other hand, one finds a certain kind of scholar who thinks he's going to get instant academic street cred if he can find fault with Lewis. He gets almost canonized by the one group and sometimes glibly patronized by the other. Meanwhile, people of almost every theological persuasion, fundamentalist, evangelical, neo-orthodox, liberal, Protestant, Roman Catholic, Orthodox, want to enlist Lewis on their side. One can read tortured attempts by all these groups to claim that Lewis was really one of them, or would have been if he just lived a little bit longer. You can understand why this is so, because the stakes are high. It's a real temptation to try to make Lewis more a proponent of your theology than he really was, because he's such a formidable ally when he is one. I will try to resist the temptation to make Lewis more of a conservative evangelical Protestant, to give full disclosure about my own position, than he really was. He is often an ally of that camp, as it rightly perceives, but not always. To honor Lewis, we first have to honor truth. Problem number two. Second difficulty arises from the fact that Lewis's most popular books and among the most theologically influential are fiction. They are fiction, but they are not, except for the Pilgrim's Regress, allegory, despite many careless statements by Lewis's readers to the contrary. An allegory is a work of symbolic fiction in which there is a fairly simple correspondence between the items or characters in the story and what they represent in the real world. For example, in Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, the characters have names like Mr. Worldly Wise Man. I wonder what he represents. Or Faithful. It's not hard to tell what they represent, and their words and actions are intended as a direct illustration of the concept that they picture. One is on pretty safe ground, then, in talking about Bunyan's theology based on Pilgrim's Progress. But Lewis's fictional writings are mostly not like that. Aslan is not simply Christ. He is Christ as he might have been if God created a world of talking animals and had been incarnated there. Lewis referred to the things that happen in Narnia or the Space Trilogy as supposals, as distinguished from allegories. He wrote to a fifth grade class in Maryland, "You're mistaken when you think that everything in the book represents something in this world. Things do that in Pilgrim's Progress, but I'm not writing that way. I did not say to myself, let us represent Jesus as he really is in our world by a lion in Narnia. I said, let us suppose that there was a land like Narnia, and the Son of God, as he became a man in our world, became a lion there, and then imagine what would happen." Probably the most important passage for understanding the relationship of the fiction to Lewis's theological beliefs may be this one. "I saw how stories of this kind could steal past a certain inhibition, which had paralyzed much of my own religion in childhood. Why did I find it so hard to feel as one was told he ought to feel about God and the sufferings of Christ? I thought the chief reason was that one was told one ought to. But supposing by casting all these things into an imaginary world, stripping them of their stained glass and Sunday school associations, one could make them for the first time appear in their real potency. Could one not thus steal past those watchful dragons?" The fiction, then, is relevant to understanding Lewis's theology. There is theology there, sneaking past watchful dragons to appear in potency. But one has to be careful about deriving theology from the fiction. On the one hand, the children learn to know Aslan and Narnia so that they might learn his other name here. "There, I have another name. You must learn to know me by that name. This was the very reason you were brought into Narnia, that by knowing me here for a little, You may know me better there. Therefore, we are intended to see parallels between Aslan or Maleldil and Christ. But we should expect those parallels to be on the level of major motifs: incarnation, sacrifice, substitution, etc. As Lewis reminds us, the only moral or doctrinal lesson that is of any value is that which arises inevitably from the whole cast of the author's mind. So we want to know what the theology is that lies behind Narnia and the Field of Arbol. But if Lewis gave us an accurate description of what he was doing, we should expect first to find it taught in expository works like Mere Christianity and Miracles, and then see it illustrated by Narnia and the Space Trilogy. And his description was accurate, for it is consistent with the kind of fiction he wrote. Third, Mere Christianity. The third complication arises from Lewis's strategy of focusing on what he called mere Christianity. In the book of that name, he deliberately tries to avoid giving any advice to people who are hesitating between two rooms in the house of Christian faith. He only wants them to get into the hall. He does tell them to look for truth rather than nice paneling or a charismatic doorkeeper, but he gives no guidelines as to which room best fits the criterion. This is a strategy he tried to follow in all of his public writing and speaking on behalf of the faith. As he wrote to Edward T. Dell in April of 1963, "A great deal of my utility has depended on my having kept out of all the dogfights between professing schools of Christian thought." Now, my point here is not to criticize Lewis for this strategy. He was certainly right that it contributed in significant ways to his usefulness. It has its advantages. I follow it in some circumstances myself. But it does present some challenges for those wishing to study Lewis's theology. For Christian doctrine is not just a random set of unrelated propositions. It's an integrated whole in which every part is related to every other part, and all find their center in the very character of the God who revealed himself in Christ to the prophets and the apostles. To leave something out because it's controversial or thought by some not to be central is not necessarily just to leave something out. The omission might have an unintended effect on what is left in. And while many denominational differences are indeed tragically peripheral, not all are. So, Lewis's mere Christianity, then, is both an asset and a liability to his ministry. One of the problems it creates is that it opens up space for speculation for those people who want to claim him for their particular position. Space that is exploited by Roman Catholics, for example. Well, surely Lewis must have thought and believed, because he leaves this space open. Fortunately, now that we have the more full three-volume set of Lewis's letters, in the letters, he sometimes allowed himself to talk privately about matters that he refused to address publicly. So if you want to get the full picture of Lewis's theology, the letters become indispensable. That's going to help us out. Finally, there's the sheer volume of Lewis's work. There's tons of it, and I don't need to elaborate on that. Conclusion. By calling C.S. Lewis an amateur theologian, I do not mean to imply that he was not a good one or in any way an unimportant one. The word should be taken in its etymological sense of one who does something not for a living but for the love of it. Love for God, love for God's truth, love for God's people. Apart from these loves, no one should presume to handle sacred things. In this sense, all the laity should be theologians and all the clergy amateurs. That Lewis had the right loves for the job is evident. His love of God helped him keep himself out of the center and Christ in it. He wrote to Mary McCaslin in August of 1594 that he was shocked to hear that your friends think of following me. I wanted them to follow Christ. They'll get over this eventually, he says, he hopes. Well, all of these loves combined with the drive for the integration of reason and imagination contributed to Lewis's greatness as a theologian, and I think they also helped him clearly see what is at stake in theology. Here is a door behind which, according to some people, the secret of the universe is waiting for you. Either that's true or it isn't. And if it isn't, then what that door really conceals is simply the greatest fraud, the most colossal sell on record. Isn't it obviously the job of every man that is a man and not a rabbit to try to find out which, and then to devote his full energies either to serving this tremendous secret or exposing and destroying this giant humbug? Lewis so devoted his energies, and he can help us to do so too. Well, I think I can best sum up Lewis's importance as a theologian by applying to him words that he said about Milton. In his description of Paradise Lost, I think it fits us as we read Lewis's works as well. We are summoned not to hear what one particular man thought and felt about the fall, but to take part under his leadership in a great mimetic dance of all Christendom, ourselves soaring and ruining from heaven, ourselves enacting hell and paradise, the fall and repentance. In that spirit, I hope to begin. I'm about four chapters into the book whose need I try to lay out here. And Lord willing, by the time we have another one of these colloquiums, you'll be able to find it on the book tables. Please pray with me to that end. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Dr. Don Williams' talk from a paper he presented earlier in 2014 at Taylor University. Remember to check the show notes at EssentialCSLewis.com for a link to download a printed copy of his talk and a link to his website. You can also find these notes at the site where my podcast is hosted, allaboutjack.podbean.com. That's spelled podbean.com. Be sure to browse my other shows, which are typically interviews with book authors, and has included all the major biographies that were released in 2013 on Lewis, as well as a handful of other releases. EssentialCSLewis.com is a feature partner site on the Middle Earth Network.